thanks. So today, I'll talk about the basics of PLEAK, try to motivate the PLEAK ADS-CFT. So basically, I'll talk about the motivation. And I will tell you what are PLEAK numbers. And also how to graphically visualize them using the Bruch-Hartzig tree. And then starting from here, we can see a very strong hint pointing towards the PLEAK CFT and also PLEAK ADS-CFT. This connection is supported by further evidence I will shortly review. So I'll call it SPT3 for short. And finally, I will bring up some puzzles and open questions in this area. All right. So for the motivations, we know that back in the 80s, there are plenty of work on this so-called PLEAK string. So basically, you calculated the endpoint scalar amplitude on this PLEAK open string string worksheet. And they have some nice number theoretic properties, which I will mention. So we know that the PLEAK string is a discretization, to some extent, of the worksheet. But the target space, namely the spacetime, is still the usual spacetime. If one wants to further discretize the spacetime, it's a good choice to use the PLEAK ADS-CFT. So this is invented in 2016 by two independent groups. This is by Dobser and his collaborators. And this, the second paper is by a Caltech group, Matilda McCauley. It's funny that this is also an East and West Coast papers. and the number of authors also match.
Is it a coincidence that the groups developed it at the same time, or was there some trigger that they both were affected by?
So they approached from very different angles, but they, surprisingly, many of the results overlap, and they can cross-check each other. So this one is more analytical, in a sense of negative, and this is more algebraic. Okay. The very interesting thing is that this periodic thing does not appear in physics for the first time in the context of periodic string, but it enters physics in the context of spin class. So it's a decade earlier than periodic string. So mainly, you have some autonomous electricity property in the state space of the spin class. So I will mention it in the when I talk about particles. So autonomous electricity is also one critical property of the of those periodic numbers. That's with the mission names. Arisi and Mozart and others.
Was this something that was sort of realizing the periodics, or is it just that periodics were a useful toy model?
The periodic, I think, in this case, it's very useful to as a tool to study the Hamiltonians and some disorder.
But it's not that the physical system was directly somehow realizing the theory.
I don't think so. Also, okay, so let's talk about the periodic numbers. So there's a well-established mathematical theorem which was proved more than 100 years ago, saying that if I give you the field of rationals, you only have two ways to complete it. So in the sense that all the Cauchy sequences converges. So the first one is the very familiar real number. So I should say the is Ostrovsky theorem. So by completion, so if you want to complete some number field, you always need the norm or the absolute value. So this the norm you use to complete rationals to real numbers is just the usual distance measure. Another possibility is to complete into the periodic numbers. So with a very funny norm, which I will say it now. So use this periodic norm.
There's infinite set of those, right? For every p, there's a...
Oh, yeah, sorry. I forgot to mention that p is any point. So there's really a democracy between r and each q, so p.
Can r be sought as a limit of...
R can be written as q sub infinity. So, yeah.
For rationals, does the periodic norm agree with the rational norm I would use to define a Cauchy sequence?
No, so I will spell it out.
So in what sense is it a completion of? Just in a set theoretic?
It's a completion in the new norm.
Yeah.
You put a new norm on the rationals and then complete it.
But then the question is, what makes it unique? Why the thick ones, these are the only completions. And if we're not preserving anything except the set of the rationals, then I can make all kinds of other completions by mapping the rationals to the rationals by an arbitrary function and then using one of these completions. So there must be some other structure we're preserving, and the question is, what is that other structure? If there's a uniqueness there.
Yes, complete with respect to a new norm. So, okay, so there are several rules. That obviously we try to assign the periodic norm of zero as a zero, and the periodic norm of some integer a, which runs from 1 to p minus 1 as 1, and and the periodic norm of p to the n is 1 over p to the n. So the basic idea is that we want to view p as a small parameter, which you can use it to expand in the decimal presentation of a number. Number two is
P is small.
In the sense of this new norm.
Okay. So P infinity is actually zero. So integers, which is not divisible by the prime P, are of the same size. So that's seen from this rule.
I'm sorry, just let me say, so p plus 1 has norm 1?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
So there's an additional rule or something, correct? You haven't covered all the numbers in the rules until you specify how to compose them.
No, rule 2 covers everything else. It's with rule 2, it's done.
It doesn't stop at p minus 1, it includes p plus 1?
Yes, so, okay, we can try to look at p plus 1. So, it does not stop at p minus 1. Okay, so in short,
sorry, what's the answer for the mod of p plus 1?
It's 1.
Okay.
So we can combine this rule and write it as this one. So if I give you arbitrary rationals, and if you can bring out the factor p and some a and b which are prime to p, then you can calculate the periodic norm of this rational as p to the negative b. And if you want to write it in terms of the decimal presentations, so for any c belongs to QP, is a unique expansion, which is very like the Laurent polynomial. So you write c as the integer part and the fractional part. So this is a decimal point. And and it stops somewhere at a sub minus v. So it's a Lorentz in the sense that you have this fractional pulse. Then the norm of the C is just P to negative V. And V is the smallest index such that A sub B is not zero.
Why does it stop?
That's the definition of the phiatic number. They're terminating.
So they're terminating on the right instead of on the left.
It's related to P being a small.
Should be thought of it
as a small number.
So if you want to do some exercise.
By decimal expansion, you mean the P is symmetric. These are powers of P, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. I should understand as P to the 0, P to the 1, P to the square.
But are there rational numbers which are not phiatic?
No.
Because they are an extension of rational, so every rational number is a phiatic number.
Because all Q
for a rational number, the expansion terminates?
Yes. On both sides, it terminates. But for
the decimal expansion of a rational number doesn't terminate, right? Like
1/3
is an infinite expansion.
So I can.
Yeah. So the A's are what they're not. So if you write 1/3 as answers, what how would you write
it? You mean A as 1/3.
But Z is 1/3.
Z as 1/3. Z 1/3. Okay.
Then it's not the prime number, so.
So. So we can.
An example would be good. Z equals 1/3 with P equals 7 would be illustrative.
How do you write
it? So Z, if Z is 1/3, and. So if you consider rational, let's call it X. And then if you want to do the decimal expansion in p equals 5, the answer you get will be, if I remember correctly, it should be this one.
Oh, I see, it's going to infinity in the other direction.
So yeah, that's right.
This is a weird expansion.
So I think if we do something like 1 over 5 minus 2 and then do series expansion in 5.
Yeah,
so 5 as if it is a small number.
Yeah, so this case is a bit. Delicate, but I can show you how to do minus 1. Minus 1 for p equals 2. Oh, actually, for finding p.
Yeah.
So you can write minus 1 as p minus 1 over 1 minus p. That's true in any field. And then,
so far, so
then you just write 1 over 1 minus p as 1 plus p plus p squared plus w. And you have p minus 1. You have wrong. So then you can try to match this formal. So you should think of this as a formal series. Try to match this formal series with this decimal expansion. So you get P naught has 1, so that's 1 here, and P to the 1 has as 1, the coefficient is 1, so A1 should be 1. So this should be, it's hard to bring out the brackets, but for P equals P2, it's just
sorry, p minus 1 is always less than p. So in this case, isn't it that all the integer, all the a's are p minus 4? Because all of these
that's right. Yeah.
Are right. Yeah, arbitrary p.
I'm just an example of p equals 2.
And just to make sure, for example, a number like 1 over p would have a norm that is p. Is that correct? So the rule there applies for negative n as well.
That's right. Yeah. So the rule is if you do the series expansion, the larger power you get, you should be more happier.
So in some sense, 0 is not in the neighborhood of 1 over p to some public power.
That's right.
Because the norm will blow up, but 0 has the norm, which is 0.
Yeah, that's why I label the axis. So I will explain this after I introduce the PP tree. P plus. Okay. And another convenient definition is the p-adic integer. It's denoted by z sub p, not to be confused as the abelian group zp. So if you want to write zp and the abelian group in the same paper, you'd better use the notation z mod pzp for the group. So this is defined as a set of p-adic numbers such that the norm not exceeding 1. So we see that the name integer become manifest if we consider the expansion, right? If we only have this integer part, the norm never exceeds 1.
There are infinitely many of them.
Yes. So you can treat it as some kind of unidisc inside of this space of p-adic numbers.
An integer would still mean that if you write it out in this p representation, it doesn't have anything after the decimal point.
That's right. Yeah. So that's a very good name for this number.
So 1/3 is an integer.
1/3 is turns out to be an integer in Q5.
But not all rational numbers integers.
That's right.
What's the special property that makes 3 and if it makes 1/3 an integer? Is he fine?
Well, I think it's not 1/5.
It's not a fifth, that's what I mean. Are all fractions that in the obvious form don't involve 5 as integers, or is it?
It's a natural conjecture.
I guess they are, in fact. So yeah. That's the statement, isn't it?
Let me see.
So there's a 5 that give you an integer.
According to that rule, they have one.
Yeah, I guess there's some like a deeper explanation if you consider it in terms of the algebraic notion and so I forgot to say that to determine this decimal presentation, you should just use a long division. So I will not go into that. So long division in the sense that you have the remainder part. But k only runs from 1 to 4. And you will see a unique k which makes A and B harder to find. Okay, so any more questions for periodic numbers?
Yes.
So if you have a negative one, you sort of take care of the minus sign in one go, or the first step, and then you keep, I mean, A and B all positive in the rest of it.
Yeah, that's right.
Sorry, I didn't quite understand this. Norm. The norm of Z is P to the minus V. So, but then you say V is the smallest index such that AV is non-zero.
Oh, sure.
I'm confused by that. It seems to be
minus
sign, right?
Yeah. Minus V. Okay. Thanks. Okay, so let's move on to this so-called duality tree. So there are two equivalent definitions for it. The one is more visual, which is that graph. And another one is more rigorous, and is based on the lattice three-dimensional lattice QP, which allows us to analyze the isometric group of this BT tree. So I will not spend time on this one, but I will show you the answer that the isometric group of this so-called BT tree is PGL. QP, which I will explain later. Okay, so let's...
That's a subgroup of the isometric group.
Oh, that's the full group.
I think that's not supposed to be the full.
So I think you're thinking of PGL2CP?
No. I thought the isometric group of the tree was actually hard to describe and not just this.
You meant there could be many more symmetries other than this?
Yeah.
Well, if you want to like map vertices to vertices, then
I thought they were
and then you maintain the relation that if these two points, if these two vertices are connected before and then after the mapping, they're still connected by one edge.
Right.
Then
are you going to say more about what the tree is?
Yeah, I will say more. Right. So let's first talk about the visual way of defining it. So that's achieved with the help of this decimal expansion. Let's start with visual one. So from this expression, we can if there are like common factors of P to the V, we can bring out P to the V in the front and shift the index in the expansion by V. So if I write it down. This form. So previously, the A sub minus V is not zero, but I shifted the index by V and bring out the common factor P to the V. So we see from this rule, we know that the periodic norm of this periodic number is entirely determined by this prefactor.
You mean P to the minus V?
In the norm.
Yeah. One is P to the minus V, but the number is P to the V.
P to the V. So now we reach this graphical presentation. So as promised, this is a tree, and if we have a tree, we have a trunk. The trunk is the orange line, and we have other branches. So the purpose of this trunk is that so where you so consider you have a path from the infinity down below running upwards, and where you leave this trunk determines the ignore of the number you will reach in the end. So there is another axis on top, which labels all the PID numbers. So there are many of them, and you try to reach those points from below. So what you will do is to set up a path, and at some point you need to leave the trunk and go into the wide branches and then move up. So we have seen that the norm of the P to the negative 2 is norm P squared. So combined with this expansion, we see that any PID numbers we reach by leaving at this point will have a PID norm P squared. And if you want to get some PID number with smaller norm, you should leave later, leave the trunk later.
What's the significance of the fact that each vertex has three outgoing lines?
Oh, that's a very good point. So here I draw the case Pico 3. So this tree is a homogeneous tree with a valence P plus 1. So how do you see that the answer is P plus 1 for the valence? It's quite easy if we resort to these decimal expansions. So for the first index, we only have P minus 1 choices. Oh, sorry, P minus 2 choices. P minus 1 from 1 to minus 1. So that corresponding the number of choices we leave the trunk. So we have two choices here. But later on, there's no restriction that these decimal points, these decimals cannot be zero. So then you have actually p choices. So a sub say minus 1 and run from 0 to p minus 1. So you have p choices that correspond to the number of branches here. So you have three choices here. That's why you have three, and another the way you conform. So they add up to p plus 1.
So each layer basically corresponds to another digit in the expansion, and the choice
that's
which
right.
branch you go on is the number that you get.
That's right. So I can label. So if you like, I can choose a path, the two paths going from here, here, and here, and so on. So the choice here corresponds to, so there's a placeholder here. And the second decimal after the decimal point is 1. And here there's a placeholder, a 2. And if you go further upwards, you have 0, 1, 2. Here 0.02, 0.12, and 0.22. And you can go for the alpha course. So here you can have 0, 0, 0, 2, 1, 0, 2, 1, 0, and so on. I hope this presentation is clear. So in fact, it's a remake of a figure in the Gapser's paper, where he presented the tree in terms of p equals 2.
And sorry, just to confirm, to reach the QP line, you actually need to go through infinite number of branches. Is that correct?
That's right.
Because it's not terminating on the left.
That's right.
Isn't it more natural to write the number in a 1 over p extension basis, base in terms of, instead of p base? Because then it would look like it would reverse all the coefficients.
Yeah, that's a good point. I haven't thought about it.
Personally, there's some rule for adding the numbers, right? The rule for adding two numbers? Is there a rule for adding two numbers?
Yes, that's right. It's the same addition rule as usual. So you
carry over to the
And you carry over to the left.
Yeah, you carry over all the overflow.
Is there some natural place where Q lives, or it's just
Q?
The original.
I think that's a p-dependent question, actually.
We already have examples where you need an infinite sequence. That's right.
That's right. Presumably, there's some pattern embedding Q on these. It's a
when you change p, it jumps around in a fairly random way that I have no idea if there is any easy interpretation. I don't know. It just jumps around.
Is there a sense that it's dense? Q is dense in QP?
Yes, I'm sure.
And should I think about the ordering? Is there a natural ordering in QP such that I just compare the digits?
So you want to compare the...
For example, if I want to compare which one is larger.
I don't think so, except for the periodic norm. So many of them are just have equal...
Which is size. The tree really means that all the branches are interchangeable. You can't distinguish the size.
I see.
So you can interchange these...
Also, you don't. The branches are ultimately it's not ordered upstairs. I mean, if you go along some branch and you end up on the right of going along some other branch, that first number is not bigger than the second number.
Yeah. So I should say that every point up to some vertices up to some point form an equivalence class that you only have finite accuracy approximating the final destination. So, say, let's say the final...
Right, so it's not like chunks on that thing, we have the same norm.
Yeah.
As far as norm is concerned, it's only determined by the main branch.
Right.
Everything that grows out of one of the points of the main branch all have the same norms.
But it ends up... The branches don't intersect, right? So it ends up upstairs... ordered correspondingly, doesn't it?
I don't think they are ordered.
Does the bottommost branch going up end up on the right of, say, the topmost one?
You're not supposed to think about the top as being a one-dimensional line. The boundary of this thing is the p-adic numbers, and they don't have the kind of ordering that you want to assign them to a position on the line.
I see. So it's not like you squeeze in all of these infinitely many branches, but they still end up on the top line in the same order as...
Right, but the ordering is not real.
Okay.
properly. It's a bit misleading with this arrow.
Is there some way to describe the difference, the norm of the difference of two parts, or is that is that a natural thing?
It's another natural thing. I think he's going to talk about that. Okay. Difference between norms isn't that geodesic.
It's the height of their most recent common ancestor.
And can I ask, so far as a representational tool, we could have done the same thing for just the ordinary decimals and the ordinary, just real numbers, but we usually don't. So, would it be clear why is this a useful thing to do here?
You wouldn't represent minus one, by the way.
Well, minus you could take out and then you have one. I mean, you could certainly have a branch choice for every digit at every level. You just, the level counts which digit and then which branch counts the actual number. So that same didn't, had nothing to do with the RAM number plus one of choices.
Sorry, Brian, if you wanted to use this norm for...
No, not the norm, just the representation in terms of tree. You can represent any standard number this way.
But the norms are encoded in the tree. So suppose I want x1 minus x2, they would correspond to GV6 on this tree, which is how the ADS-CFD business would become very convenient on this tree.
I don't know what is the advantage if you want to present the real number of this tree. I'm running short of time. But I'll talk about the options of APS or PLX. As usual, for CFT, you need to think of the boundary of this Bruhat tree. And it's similar to CP1 if you consider the two-dimensional boundary. So here we have the boundary of the BT tree as the projective line over the QP. So it is defined as the union of all QP with the infinity. And we hope to define the CFT on this boundary.
I'm sorry, could you define that again? I think it's going to be important. I just really didn't catch what you...
So you can think of the boundary of this tree as the this periodic axis union is infinity.
So the boundary is just all the periodic numbers for a fixed p. And then what do you mean union with what?
Union with infinity. It's
you mean with like a point at infinity?
Yeah.
With one element?
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's similar as so in the same spirit. A very nice thing is that the isometric group in the bulk equals the conformal group on the boundary, which is just this PGR2QP. So this is just a projective of this GR2QP. So whenever you have the M and M prime inside for this. You can think of it as a 2x2 matrix. So whenever they are related by a scalar, periodic, which is non-zero, then you identify them as the same element inside the PJ of the QP. So in bulk, as usual, the isometric group just shift those points around, but keep the connectedness. So on the boundary, the action is also the familiar fractional linear transformation. X, PID number, let's go to AX plus B over CX plus B, and ABCD belongs to the PD of the QP. So there are multiple attempts of defining a so-called periodic CFT. After all, if you want to study the ADS-CFT, you better have a clear definition of the, what is the CFT. So one key feature of this group PG of the QP is that if you just consider the usual host of topology, it is a totally disconnected group. Namely, it's hopeless if you want to reach an arbitrary points in the PJ2QP starting from the identity. And you can also see from the definition of the periodic exponential, it is difficult, it's impossible to define an infinitesimal map which brings you from the identity to arbitrary points. So the reason so this is just defined in terms of the usual Taylor series.
There's some notion of just calculus on this, or it's just we're just dealing with the Taylor expansions, and we don't have a notion of derivatives.
That's right. You have the whole tool of the integration and differentiation on the Taylor number. Yes, but I will not talk about that.
But that's the thing that we would choose. So then the CFT lives on some platform where sort of the nearby is defined in that sense, whatever that is.
We'll mention that probably. If you match this and this decimal expansion, you see that the radius for convergence is P minus, need to check my notes, minus 1 over. Minus 1 over P minus 1. So you don't expect that if you start from 0, you can reach to any point. So for example, if p equals 3, e to the 1 and e to the 2 all blows up. And I also should be clear about the fields in periodic CFTs. So the fields, they are over periodic numbers, so they are functions over Q sub P. But for convenient reasons that we demand them still to be complex values. I'm not sure if you can see that. Do this one. And there's another property from periodic interspecific analysis because all well-behaved functions over the periodic fields are locally constant. So really, all their derivatives with respect to the base field is zero.
Is it just?
It's a function from QP.
So is there a notion of a complexified QP space or?
Yes. But I don't think it will play an important role. Yeah.
So should I think of this as like a one-dimensional CFT? I guess
maybe it's not. Yeah. It's secretly a one-dimensional CFT. But I guess I don't have enough time.
I don't think it's any more one-dimensional than it is two-dimensional.
yeah, it's a hybrid, I'd like to think.
It's not really either. So.
Yeah, so it's depending on the context, you can think of it as one-dimensional or two-dimensional.
It's definitely not three-dimensional.
No, definitely
not. I don't think it has any particular relation in that way to.
Can you remind me what's F?
Oh, F is just a field. Are there
derivatives on this?
To show that there's no derivative, there's a very nice trick. So being locally constant means they can always build up arbitrary such functions by just piece together all the so-called indicator functions on some open set in QP. So these indicator functions are 1 or 0. 1 if it is inside the set, but 0 outside. I think I'll just set as S. And so it is clear that psi equals psi squared. So if we want to take the derivative of psi x over x, the same as taking derivative of psi squared over x. But by Leibniz's rule, this is just 2 psi, because we're assuming they're commuting, psi over x. The psi is not a, it is never 1. So the only choice is d psi over dx is 0. And so this property that they have vanishing derivatives along with another property that I haven't mentioned, that this automatricity, they highly constrain the OPE of this periodic set. So basically all fields are primaries and OPEs are all exact. Descendant. And another feature is that the 2-point, 3-point, and 4-point functions are all fixed by the conformal symmetry, PGL. So this is nicely axiomized in Melzer's paper back in 1989. So I'd like to call it as Melzer's axioms. So this is the best axioms we have up to now for periodic set. I'm running short. I'll just bring out several puzzles in this area.
Maybe this isn't the right time to ask this, so just tell me, but the first step of the plan was motivation. And what you mentioned there was previous cases where people have considered periodic numbers mm-hmm. in relation to physics, but I still didn't hear the motivation. So why did they consider it? Why are we considering it now? Like, what is the motivation here? It's an interesting mathematical structure, but physics, why are we looking at it?
So I guess the strongest motivation is twofold, one from the periodic stream. So previously people only discretized the worksheet, and so now the two groups asked.
I think I'm asking you for like a prior to that step. Mm-hmm. Why, what's the goal? Like,
well, I think, It's based on the democracy between R and the QP. So if we can do all the physics in R, then why?
So it's like a...
Why don't we consider QP?
So since QP exists as a completion of the rationals, maybe God made use of it, and we should look into it?
Yeah, that's a philosophy back in the 80s. Well, one of the philosophies.
It's a model that could be sort of mathematically natural, and in the context of string theory, there was a slightly different motivation, which was that there was actually a relation between certain string amplitudes and products of periodic string amplitudes. But more generally, you could just think of it as some kind of a toy model for ADS-CFT that is a little bit simpler, and maybe you could learn something from it.
So I would encourage you to check out this paper by Fund and Witten. So they have this very nice periodic relation between Venezuelan 4-point functions, which is very similar to another theory of identity. So, in short, we have so if you calculate the Venezuelan amplitude for So this input is from the periodic stream for all possible key. And also you multiply them together with the ordinary amplitude, you'll get a 1. And this is it's a long story in the number theory that you will also get some similar properties if you consider the so-called adels. So,
can I interject? How long do you think you have to finish?
Oh, probably.
Because you want to get Janet.
Yeah, so probably in 5 minutes.
Sorry? Speaking
in 5 minutes.
Maybe really quickly.
Yeah.
Try to summarize.
Okay.
I think, yeah.
So, but I would say some puzzles in Ethics 70. So for the symmetry group, we only have the global group. We don't have the local algebras. So we lose the description based on the highest weight representation of the universal algebras. Can we just use the group representations to deal with the Pierre-Luc safety? So in our recent paper, so one of the results is, if you stick with the axioms, all the certs you got are automatically unique. So there's a mathematical classification of these URFs.
So what does unitary mean in this context? Are these defined quantum theories of some kind?
Yeah, so it's unitary in the usual sense.
But the correlators are expectation values in a Hilbert space of positive and norm.
Reflection for some kind of reflection positive.
Is there a notion of time? I mean, do you have like a lattice, this sort of weird lattice, and things evolve smoothly on that one?
Yes.
So time is PL?
No, no. Can we take time and then it's very different from time. That's what I thought he was agreeing.
Mm-hmm. What is the reflection? Reflection positive.
The boundary is supposed to include all the dimensions, right? So time should be one of the dimensions of the boundary.
So time is one of those?
Yeah, I don't know how to answer the question.
The way I understand it, at least for the models that I worked with, time is not real, it's still p-adic. That is the most natural form that would utilize all the symmetries. I know that some models, for example, considered by the Caltech group when they constructed these tensor networks wave functions, I think they corresponded to real time, but space is p-adic. But I think when I work with tensor networks, they are not so natural. So when I start talking about it, it would both space and time. I don't even know how to separate space and time. That is another question that is part of the puzzles. Whether there's a Lorentzian generalization,
but I would seems to have Euclidean time.
That's true.
Euclidean
I would be
time.
I would be, but in I would be thinking about basically Euclidean, that's more natural, I think.
So that's why I was asking what unitary means in this context.
So maybe he was thinking about real time, but whatever.
So, okay, so this is a mechanical theorem that's saying all the UFs are either complex one dimensional or infinite dimensional. And here you also have a similar classification to the SL2R representations. So you have this principal series, actual representations. And there's a very curious one called supercomputer. Anyway, so these are all the possible representations. And in the same paper, we calculated the partition function in the background of the BTC black hole, the periodic BTC black hole. So previously, we see the tree. And in the periodic ADS-FT, we just identify the tree as the global ADS, the zero configuration one. But in the Caltech group, so this is, they have this construction that by modding out the tree by some short key, so the projective line by the short key group, you can get a central polygon in the middle. And you get the infinitely running branches to the boundary. So in this sense, you can think of this periodic SFT as some kind of two-dimensional one, because you have a BTC-like construction. Okay, so calculated the partition function in background, and it involves some like Chebyshev polynomials. And then we propose that the way to picking out the right representation is just using the traits. So pi is the representation, some possible representations, and this is the Schottky group we use to generate the BTC. So the length of the BTC L is a free parameter. You can adjust this Schottky group to get that, and so V is the representation space of the UFs, and pi is the representation. So we haven't done this step yet, but we'd like to answer the question in some future work. And this trace function always exists because the PGL ZQP is this totally disconnected group, but discounted by some mathematical theory. Okay, so I guess that's all I want to talk about.
I'll try to say everything that I have to say within half an hour, and hopefully
take the microphone.
I'd like to thank Haoyu for agreeing to give a review of the periodic numbers and so on. I'm a terrible mathematician. I'm not a mathematician at all, so I'd feel more comfortable if someone more mathematically inclined gives an introduction of the subject. So what I'm going to do is to say why the periodic ADS-CFT is a very good background for testing some of the ideas that we have in tensor network. In fact, because it is naturally a discrete space, and so it is very easy for us to put a tensor network on it while preserving all the symmetries of the p-adic CFT. So I think there wasn't enough time for Haoyu to say what is p-adic CFT and p-adic ADS CFT for that matter, so let me just say very quickly what they are. So maybe I'll erase. So as he mentioned, the p-adic CFT is supposedly, we're talking about CFT that lives on the QP, but the fields themselves are complex, or real valued or complex valued. And so Melzer gave a set of axioms that would make a CFT a well-defined. And the set of data that he needs to define the p-adic CFT, it's basically we need a set of the spectrum, the primary fields, and also given the spectrum of the CFT, you need structure coefficients. That tells you how the OP coefficients, how operator spills. And as Haoyu has already mentioned, basically these OP coefficients, these OPE, x1, x2, x1 minus x2 delta minus delta A minus delta B plus delta C. Basically, it behaves, the fusion behaves as if there are only primaries. And so this sum over C, but then there's only one term in the OPE expansion. There isn't any descendant terms for the reasons that Haoyu has explained. And so the in particular, the conformal blocks are pretty trivial. Also, one other thing about these norms is the ultra metricity that is of note, and that is whenever you have 3 points x1, x2, and x3, then it always forms an isosceles triangle, as in so these 3 points, you always have two of the legs having equal length. So for so I think ultra metricity is what that means, and it is it would become a property of this tree. Okay, so.
The CABC should satisfy an associativity.
Oh yes, very good, very good. Yes, sorry. So for CABC, because these are describing fusion of the operators OA and OB, and so we would assume that it is part of the axioms to assume that the fusion is associative. Okay, and because of the fact that there aren't any descendants, and also using ultra metricity, then you can show that the four-point functions you have crossing symmetry, but then the crossing symmetry only gives you constraints on the structure coefficients, namely that as long as they are associative, it satisfies all the constraints, and we don't get extra constraints as in the usual conformal usual CFT, where the you can extract lots of bootstrap equations that are highly non-trivial from the four-point functions. The conformal blocks only have one term in the expansion, and therefore it doesn't give you anything extra other than associativity of the fusion coefficients. Yes.
What about modulo invariants?
For the same reason, I will try to say two words about modulo invariants if I have time, which I probably. But the problem is, I don't think the complete modulo group. I think it looks somewhat different, as in. These kind of things, I don't really know how to describe it in full when I deal with higher genus surfaces. So let's not worry about that for now. And so it is a very simple CFT. So what about ADS CFT? So as how you explained, the BT tree is the BT tree really is. You could think of it as the quotient of PGL2QP by its maximal compact subgroup, or I think it's PGL2ZP. So in that sense, it is really the direct analog of the upper half plane. And so this is a very natural, this makes the BT tree a very natural analog of the upper half plane, and that is where we would put the dual theory on this tree. And so what Gupta and the Caltech group did with the p-adic with defining the p-adic ADS CFT is to say, okay, suppose this is the bulk theory, and now let's put a scalar theory that lives on this bulk. By putting a scalar theory on this bulk, you really mean that I write down an action and let's say put a scalar field that lives on the vertices of this tree, and then let's write down a kinetic term, vi, vj, and then maybe some mass terms, and let's solve for, so let's write down such a theory that lives on this tree. Let's write down the Klein-Gordon equation of this tree by varying with respect to this action, and then let's solve for the solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, solve for the Green's function, and do exactly what we do in the usual story of ADS-CFT. Let's say computing a two-point function of the boundary theory, then I would need bulk boundary propagator. So this is the boundary of the ADS space. This direction, I can think of it as the radial direction. And so let's compute the Green's bulk boundary, Green's function of this action. And then if I have operator inception at the boundary theory, then I look for the bulk boundary propagator, and then this path moves along the tree, and then so I compute basically Witten diagrams on this tree. So that was what was being done in Gupser and friends. And to show that the correlation functions of the p-adic CFT can be reproduced naturally using exactly the usual p-adic, usual ADS CFT dictionary as we know it. So in particular, for example, if you have a two-point function, the two-point function has exactly this form, and a three-point function is basically x1 minus x2 delta a plus delta b minus delta c. So basically, the two-point function, three-point function, and so on, looks exactly like what we would have done using the usual usual CFT, except we replace all the norms by the p-adic norms. So a three-point function would look like x1 minus x2, x1 minus x3, and then delta 1, 1, 2, minus 3, 1, 3 minus 2 x 2 x 3 2 plus 3 minus 1, for example, for a three-point function. So how does these things look from the point of view of the p-adic tree? So for example, the two-point function, it directly, this x1 minus x2 to the power 2 delta, it's basically reproduced on this tree using the Green's function of a Green's function that propagates along. Okay, let me be more explicit. Let's say I do a cutoff surface here. And so let's say I have operator insertion here, O1 and O2. Then the geodesic that connects O1 and O2 is precisely this line here. And so what is amazing about this tree that is connected to the connection between this tree and the p-adic norms is that if you look into p minus, if I look into p minus delta d, and d is the distance between d is the distance of the geodesic that connects this 2 point.
Distance defined how?
Count the number of links. 1, 2, 3. So here 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So d would be 6 in this case. So obviously, if these points are taken to infinity, d is infinity. Of course, so I do have to do a cutoff. And one cutoff method, so Boopser thought about introducing counter terms, but there are other ways. The Celtic group considered that every distance, I choose a special point here, and then I normalize every operator by dividing the distance between any operator insertion at a cutoff surface with the distance between the operator insertion with some specified point in the bulk. So there are different ways of regulating this distance. But the important point is this is basically up to regularization proportional to x1 minus x2 to the 2 delta. And also, this object itself is proportional to the Green's Green's function that satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation on this graph, yes.
How do you define the metric in the tree?
Oh, very good. This is not, we don't know how to define a metric, and so the kind of action that is written here assumes that all the edges have the same length, and I'm just writing down so there's no metric explicit. Of course, later, Gubser and company, they introduce an edge length, so they introduce the notion of lengths on this graph, and then couple it to the action. But there's not a very easy, simple, there's no easy, notion of metric, but this is also something that, sorry, yes.
Okay, can I rephrase the discussion as following? So if I have the BG tree and I have this classical field theory and I try to calculate the boundary two-point function, I find it's natural to use the p-adic norm.
That's right.
I don't need to start with p-adic, but I find it by
that's right. You would find that you work with this tree, you work with geodesics, then you naturally see that the lengths, the geodesic distance is telling you about p-adic norms. That's right. Up to careful choice of boundary conditions of this infinite tree.
So normally, so the distance d is going to infinity, right?
That's right.
Is x1 minus x2 finite in this formula? Or?
Oh, no. So that's why I said... of course, if I the cutoff is at
the diversion constant.
That's right.
Okay.
It just means that I have to normalize each operator, and the way I normalize it is based on the distance to a designated point.
We do have a similar depth vector sourcing the
operator. Yes.
Is there like generalization of spin for these p-adic CFTs?
I think so the Celtic group discussed some generalization of spin, and what they were thinking was making an analogy with the 1+1 dimensional CFT where you have some delta 1 minus delta 2, h left minus h right sort of way of thinking about spins. That is for the boundary theory, and for the bulk theory, I think people have started considering putting gauge degrees of freedom, gauge field degrees of freedom on the edges, and so on. But I don't think it is very well understood, because spins. Sorry.
Is there a parameter n that suppresses the fluctuations of the shape of the tree or the topology of the tree?
Okay. Right now, the tree is not dynamical itself. Okay. As far as the in the case where Gubser started considering edge fluctuations, I think he puts in by hand the coupling that determines the fluctuations of the size of these edges. But as far as the boundary theory, So people, of course, they can start considering the fluctuation of the shape of this tree. But what does that correspond to from the point of view of the boundary theory? I think that is not known. In the usual story of ADS-CFT, the edges corresponds to, the length, the metric corresponds to fluctuations of the stress tensor. But here, there is no, the connection is unclear. Sorry. Is there any? Sorry, yes.
Zero stress tensor.
Sorry?
Zero stress tensor.
Very good. Because we don't know what is Lie algebra, precisely for the reason that we don't know how to talk about infinitesimal distance and exponentiate. Therefore, we don't know how to define stress tensor. But I hope I will be able to say a few words about that as well, because we have made some, a little bit of progress in that direction. Okay, so what I intended to do was to give a very lightning review of what we have about CFT, p-adic CFT. The data is spectrum, structure constants, and then the correlation functions just follows from symmetry. Then we have p-adic CFT, which is the bulk is this tree, and we do usual ADS-CFT treating the bulk as our bulk space-time. And then so far, it works fairly well. And so my goal, some of these things that I thought about talking is to see that, okay, this looks like a fairly simple theory, a simple situation. Is it possible that some of the tensor network ideas that we have can be realized in a very quantitative way in the setting of the p-adic ADS-CFT? And the answer appears to be yes. There are several quantitative things that can be very readily realized here. It might be because of kinematics, because there's so much symmetries, but maybe it has some deeper meaning. So let me try to say what we can do, what kind of things tensor networks can do on this tree, summarize what we have. So one extra remark about tensor network is that we already know that tensor networks, people start to relate tensor networks with ADS-CFT because of the RT formula, and that it looks very similar to what happens on mirror, and so it looks like the bulk is a natural geometrization of the entanglement structure of the boundary theory, and also many people in this room noticed that causality has something to do with error correcting properties. But there's actually one other point that I feel that it is not very not so commonly stressed in the gravity literature, and that is very readily realized in the context of tensor network, and that is the relationship between global symmetry and gauge symmetry. So we all know that global symmetries in the boundary theory corresponds to gauge symmetries in the bulk, and this is just very naturally realized in the case of tensor network, because if I have a tensor network trying to realize some wave functions with some global symmetries at the boundary, what is the most natural way to build up the interior tensors? It is to make sure that every single tensor project the length to a singlet of the representation of the symmetry group. Then automatically, when I act symmetry transformation on all the boundary legs, then I would automatically recover invariance of the wave function. And therefore, global symmetry of the boundary, but then because I'm imposing singlet condition at every interior vertex in the tensor network, this global symmetry in the boundary theory is naturally recovered as gauge symmetry in the bulk. And so this is something that is actually a very natural relation in any tensor network construction that you get almost for free. Okay, so now let me say what is the tensor network construction that we have. Oh, let me also say that the tensor network construction of p-adic ADs CFT was also considered by the Caltech group, but they were more concerned about constructing wave functions. But again, wave function assume that we have some real time, and it breaks the symmetry. It breaks some of the symmetry between some of the directions, and so what we did is to directly try to construct the partition function of the p-adic CFT rather than the wave function. And so given this bulk, what is the most natural thing to do is to just interpret this bulk as a tensor network. And so every vertex here, I have to put in a tensor. And so I have to determine two things. What is the labels, or what is the bond dimension, or the indices that I should put at put on the length? And what is the precise value of the tensor that I should put at each vertex? So we just made a very simple guess. And the guess is every vertex we would put in a the structure constant. The normalization is such that AA0 is equals to 1 to make it to work. But if I take this normalization for my operators, then every vertex I would take it as, so if I'm, I work with P equals 2, then this tensor, a three-valent tensor, is just CABC. If I work with higher P's, then I only need to split my vertex. So if this is, if there are P plus one leg here, I just need to break up the vertex into a fusion tree. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Oh, okay.
Sorry, what are CABC the constants of?
These are the structure constants of the CFT. So I want to recover, sorry? Yes, the OP coefficients. Yes, yes, yes. This is a guess, and I just want to show that this guess works, and then I would justify this guess in a way based on the connection with Wilson lines.
But this is not a tensor network in the sense that it prepares a state.
That's right. I'm preparing the partition function. I'm not preparing the state. And the reason that forced... So we have tried several things. Initially, we tried to build wave functions, but the result is not very... the result is not as powerful as if I recover the partition function. And I'll show you why in 1 second.
So why can't you think about this preparing a state? What's objection?
It's preparing the Euclidean correlators. It's giving the probability distribution that the Euclidean correlator does.
You can think about its wave function in the dissipate space.
Well, that's not what she's doing.
Right. What I was doing was to directly work out a partition function rather than a state. You're absolutely right.
Sorry.
Yes.
I don't quite get the group and vector space that's behind this. Is it a tensor in the sense that it's a tensor over a vector space?
Right.
Is that vector space with the field being the p-adic number?
Okay. So what we because the fields themselves are real valued, therefore the tensors are real valued. The fact that it lives the boundary fields lives on QP is already captured by the tree itself. And therefore, all of the tensors that I'm talking about are real or complex valued at worst.
And then it's you just have some number of operators with A labels the different primary operators.
That's right.
So you have a vector space of the dimension equal to the number of primaries.
That's right, yes. And so this, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So if I have a larger P, then the tensors are taken to be a fusion tree. Then at every leg, when I contract two tensors, I don't just contract them, but I put in a weight in the contraction. And every leg here in the contraction, I put in a power of that is proportional to P to the minus delta A. And so now, suppose I want to compute, now I'm ready to compute partition functions. So I have a cutoff surface on the tree. And if I have, so all of these in, legs have index in the spec among the operators, take values in the, are labeled by the primary operators. And so it could be the identity, I assume that there's always an identity operator, or it could be any other operator. So in the case of the vacuum partition function, then I would take all the labels at the boundary cutoff surface to be, to take the value of the identity label. And because this structure at each point here, they're just fusion coefficients. Therefore, if I put identity all over the place, it is just going to give me the same contribution at every link. It's basically giving me factors of one. And so the partition function would be the infinite products of one. Now, if I'm interested in computing two-point functions, then I would at the position at the appropriate position where I want to insert an operator, then I would project the leg to OA, and then or maybe on some other point or project to OB. Then you could see that this would fuse at this vertex, and it would just go through. Similarly here, and so I would be basically collecting powers of P to the minus delta A along this path until they reach at some vertex. And so the result of this tensor network is that I already know that when I collect P to the minus delta multiplied by the distance between two points, I'm just basically recovering the two-point correlation functions of the boundary theory up to appropriate normalization of these operators that I can specify very specifically. And so basically, you can see that two-point functions, I would be able to recover, and it is based on, and the tensor network automatically gives me this bulk boundary propagator that solves the Klein-Gordon equation in the bulk naturally. So if I'm interested in computing, let's say, three-point functions, then a similar story would show up. I would basically have, I would be collecting powers of P to the minus delta along a certain path until it hits the other operator. And then, so I would have the structure of some sort of Witten diagrams where each leg would be the contribution of each leg is proportional to the Klein-Gordon equation on this tree, and then the interaction vertices are controlled by the structure constants, the fusion coefficients of the CFT. And so basically you could try to compute three-point function, four-point function, and so on, and this pattern of Witten diagrams would automatically show up as a result of the tensor network of this particular tensor network construction. So, so of course, there's a caveat. These Witten diagrams, the vertex where the interaction occurs, is not summed over. And so that inspired the connection with Wilson lines that I will talk about very quickly in a moment. But let me say another thing that is necessary to I just talked about correlation functions and Witten diagrams. And the second thing that I want to mention is HKLL relations. And actually, this is what prompted us to look into reconstructing partition functions rather than wave functions. And so what do I mean by HKLL relations? Suppose I want to project one of the interior leg to label A. So the way I understand HKLL relation on this tensor network is to ask what kind of linear combination of projections I should do at the boundary so that I would recover exactly having an A here. So you can do the exercise with just one layer of the tensors, and then so let's say I have p equals 3, and if I want to make sure that this leg is just a, what do I do? What is the equivalent linear combinations that I should do here in order to recover a? And let's think about a slightly simpler situation where the structure constants are dominated by an operator passing through, so the interaction where A, B, C, and or non-trivial is suppressed. Let's consider that case. In which case, if I want an operator A here, then I can either have A 0, 0, or 0, A 0, or A 0, 0, plus other possibilities that are somewhat suppressed because they involve interaction terms. And note that every time every of this leg has a factor of p to the minus delta a. So in order that I have exactly a on this leg without extra factors, then I have to get I have to remove this stuff. And so what I do is that to have the correct normalization such that I have exactly a on this leg is to normalize these diagrams by p to the plus delta a. And also because I have p choices here, so I have to divide by a factor of p. So it means that when I want to recover a here, when I propagate through one tensor, I have to multiply by a factor of p delta a minus 1. If I cross, if I do two layers, then I would have two such factors. So what is so special about this? So it means that the effective propagator, when I'm working with operator reconstruction in the bulk, is automatically given by a conformal dimension, a dimension that is equals to delta a minus 1. And if you minus delta a plus 1, because these, it used to be p to the minus delta a, now it has to be b to the plus delta a minus 1. So what exactly is this relation? It says delta minus plus delta plus equals d. This is the usual relation between the normalizable modes and non-normalizable modes on a tensor network. If I were constructing wave functions, then this d would not work out correctly. So it sort of surprised us that by working, we didn't solve any differential equations. Just by thinking about operator reconstruction and computing correlation functions, these relationships between delta plus and delta minus just show up naturally on this graph as well, in the limit where interaction is less important compared to propagation. In the free field limit, this would be satisfied. And of course, and so the HKL relation works almost exactly like what happens in the usual ADS-CFT case, except now you have an explicit map between boundary and bulk degrees of freedom. Yes, please.
Why do you want to sum all three instead of just taking one out of the three? What's wrong with just taking one?
What's wrong with just taking one?
Then you wouldn't get the minus one, p to the delta minus one.
Okay. In that, it would break some symmetries. At this level, I would only say that I'm really just taking the inverse of these tensors. And so I think it is more appropriate to sum over them. And this conclusion of D rather than 1 is that actually Gubser considered higher than how to define the CFTs and also the ADS version in higher dimensions. And the way he thought about this is that one could further extend QP to even bigger fields. And depending on the relative dimension of the extension to QP, I could start defining, I would think of this relative dimension as the dimensions of the space that the CFT lives in. And so this formula would automatically works in arbitrary dimensions in the sense that these are considered in groups. So I think it is not an accident.
So P would translate directly in that sense.
Sorry?
To dimension? Or
sorry?
What's the relation between P and the dimension?
Okay, it's not, suppose I want to do two dimensions. There's another field called QP square that is an extension of QP. And so this one, locally, you could think of that as having two QP. It is parameterized by two QP numbers. And so this is how he defines high dimensions. So if in general, if I have QPN, so this number can be thought of as N QP numbers. So that is, and the construction here would automatically be correct for arbitrary D. So I think it is, and we discovered this actually when we tried working with wave function reconstruction. And there, it was based on operator pushing, and there is no such choice of picking a particular leg. This is something that we could discuss more, but we have some more reasons why you have to treat these three legs democratically. So this is a very rushed version of the tensor network construction that recovers the Witten diagrams to some extent, and the HK error relations are quite naturally for any p-adic CFT with an associative fusion algebra. Yes. So before I end, so let me say this is actually connected to some Wilson lines, and that may be useful for us to generalize these ideas when we start. There are two important points that I have to say. And one important point is, here we talked about correlation functions in a sort of pure ADS background. So we can also start thinking about defining renormalization group flows so that the boundary is no longer pure. So how do we do that? So recall that when we want to do correlation functions, we're basically projecting the boundary legs to non-trivial operators. Now, if I want to define renormalization group flow, what we do in usual ADS CFT story is that we introduce a term, JO, basically at every spot at the boundary. And so the natural thing to do here is therefore to project every of the boundary legs to a non-trivial state. And this state is, let's say, the identity plus some coupling A, right? And if I do that, then you could see that at every vertex, if I put in some tensor psi, I'm essentially defining a new tensor. So if I call this psi n, I'm defining a new tensor psi n plus 1. And so now you can see that when I start to do this kind of projection at the boundary, then there is a real kind of renormalization group flow down this tree. The tensor get renormalized as you pass through every single layer. And the contribution to the partition function at different layers are different. And so the tensor network is saying that there's some kind of change to the geometry that is encoded in this tensor network. So we looked into the fixed points of this RG flow, and we find that it would go back to a new RG flex fixed point, except that and we can show that the structure constants in the new RG fixed point would remain associative. One other thing that we could do is we are interested in the geometry that is encoded by this flowing tensor network. And so in order to talk about geometry, we have to talk about distance. And so how do we define distance in this flowing geometry? One thing that we could think of is, what if the distance between this point and this point is given by basically the overlap? Let's say it is proportional to the overlap of these tensors. So if I have, my input is psi n here, then after it passed through this free tensor, the output is psi n plus 1. So looking into the overlap is more or less defining the Fisher information metric based on these input states and output states. So we can have a notion of distance. And now we could ask the following question. Let's say to leading order in, let's say these j's are small. So I could compute up to leading order the distance, leading order in j, the distance between two points in this tensor network based on this definition. Then I could also, so I get some expression. Then I could also ask, if I have a scalar field sitting here, what is the expectation value in the presence of the sources that I've turned on at the boundary to leading order in J? So that is just given by the bulk boundary propagator of these boundary insertions. I sum over all the bulk boundary propagators inserted at all the different points to this link. And what you get is, and then you could compute you could compute a bulk stress tensor based on this scalar fields. And so what we are seeing is that the curvature that you can define on this graph based on the distance that we have defined is basically up to, at least up to leading order in this perturbation, is proportional to the kinetic term VI VJ that is defined on this graph. So at least up to linear order, at least up to leading order in J, which shows up here as quadratic order in J. These are proportional to J squared. This is proportional to J squared. They have the same functional dependence of the position. So these are not. So they basically are proportional to the distance from the cutoff surface. I don't know if this is purely a coincidence of kinematics, but there is some form of fairly quantitative Einstein-like relation that would emerge in this RG flow that is defined by the by this tensor network. So one last comment. I'm sorry, I'm totally over time. So one last comment is this tensor network. It was first pointed out to us by Jie Chao Wu, now at MIT, that this tensor network strikes him as very similar to Wilson line junctions that people have studied in the ADS-CFT literature. And so what we did is that here again, as someone mentioned, there is no notion of metric or connection, but at least. Can I define a connection on this tree and compute Wilson line networks? The idea is there is there's a coordinate that was described by Hao Yu, not in complete detail. So every point here is related to some upper triangular matrix that is written in this form. Zero. So n here tells you which layer you are in. So n is counting the layer you are in, and x tells you how far you are extended in this direction. So every single vertex here can be related to an upper triangular matrix, and this upper triangular matrix is basically a PGL 2p group element. Therefore, I can easily define a flat connection on this tree by looking into, if I'm looking at this edge, for example, I have a group element G1 here. I have another group element G2 on this other vertex. Therefore, this link here is related to some kind of group element, that is G1 minus 1 G2. And so now I can basically play the same game as the Wilson line literature, and that write down these Wilson line junctions. Basically, so every Wilson line that is connecting to point A and B, I have a natural group element that is attached to this link. This is a group element. And the representations this Wilson line is in, I can use I borrowed the literature on shadow operators in CFT. And so this object here is just 1 over x to delta. So if you're familiar with the shadow operator construction, I basically borrowed the literature on shadow operators and compute this Wilson line junctions. Every junction is basically a PGL2 QP invariant that you can construct using three-point functions of the CFT. So the end result of this construction is basically that I recover the guessed form of the tensor network every single tensor here basically agrees with this kind of Wilson line junctions. Maybe it's not surprising, but it's just what it is. So it suggests that you could probably generate some more generic wave geometry on this tensor network by exponentiating, let's say, the BTC metric. We could recover, we could use the SR2R construction of the in ADS3 and write down a connection and exponentiate it. And then, so even though we're not able to talk about Lie algebra, the exponentiation actually works very well. The Wilson line, I should also say, I forgot to say, that this group elements that I'm attached to each line, if you compare it with the usual ADS3 connection, it's just the exponentiation of the ADS3 metric connection. It's just the in ADS3, the connection is just the Vierbein plus spin connections. So you can write this down for pure ADS. And if you exponentiate that object, it between two points with a difference in rho coordinates and x coordinates, you exponentiate that object, it recovers precisely the group elements that we guessed.
On the manifold, whereas here you're getting a unique group element on each link without choosing something that corresponds to it.
I have chosen. So when I say that there is such a upper triangular matrix, I've done some gauge fixing. This kind of gauge fixing is almost identical to what you can do on ADS3. So if I do that, then I would see a direct correspondence. The exponentiation of whatever you have in ADS3 space recover this group element that you could write down here. And also the Wilson line junctions recover the tensor network that we guessed would recover all the correlation functions of the dual CFT. So maybe we could generalize this geometry by putting in a more general A, let's say, for the BTC metric, and that would allow us to consider more non-trivial curved p-adic tree backgrounds. So I'm sorry for this delay. Thank you very much.